You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner. Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. And I hope you're enjoying our latest mini-series as we look at another series of top tens. And this time our editors from around Autosport have put together their favourite top 10 lists, and we're looking at the top 10 Ligier F1 drivers today. I'm sure we're going to have some fun with this. A team full of Gallic flair since they moved from sports car racing into Formula One in 1976. And a team that would take seven seasons of Formula One entry just to realise maybe we should have a non-French driver. One of the many reasons that people will remember Ligier with a smile, I'm sure. For many reasons, the drivers and, of course, even the explosive character who we will get onto, who the team is named after. Joined today on the podcast by Marcus Simmons, who put this list together. So just tell us quickly why you were happy to do a Ligier list for us.
First of all, I'm afraid I've forgotten to bring the obligatory packet of Gitane with me. I always had a fascination with Ligier as a kid and young adult, following Grand Prix racing in the late 70s, early 80s. And they did seem to have the Gallic flair that you'd mentioned at the beginning. They had some cool drivers. They had some very quick cars. I always had a fascination with the French drivers who came up through the ranks. And we used to see regularly in Formula 2 in this country as well in the 1970s, drivers like Didier Pironi, René Arnoux, Patrick Depailler, who we may go on to talk about. Have they made our top 10? It just seemed a fantastic system that they had in place in France, and a lot of them, or some of them, went on to drive for Ligier and have success. And obviously most of the success, their most successful seasons were really 79 and 80 as far as competitiveness was concerned. But those years they were using the Cosworth V8 engine, but who can argue with a team that otherwise used the Matra V12 for their early years and just the most glorious sounding engine. And I can still hear it echoing around the amphitheatre at Brands Hatch in my mind now. Just fantastic.
probably still screaming around in your head. And joined by our chief editor, Kevin Turner, who has turned gamekeeper to poacher, from list writer to critique. Although, I don't know how this list will go, because the one we did with Minardi, you were pretty much in agreement with a lot of that list. So let's see how you go with Ligier, Kev.
Yeah, I mean, when we were looking at doing the second, the first series, the teams picked themselves, didn't they? They were all the big, they're basically the big six, the sort of recent five plus Lotus. And then we thought, well, I want to do a second series because there are a few big teams that no longer exist. And then there are also a few teams that were around a long time that perhaps didn't achieve, you know, the top results. So I thought it would make it quite a fun thing to do for the second series to look at those teams. But it's an awful lot harder when you're looking at drivers and teams that spent a lot of the time in the midfield, or occasionally, like in Ligier's case, they were all over the place. Sometimes they were very competitive and almost in championship contention, and in other days they were sort of midfield towards the back. So comparing drivers across those different eras is very difficult, which is why I decided to cop out and ask a few of my colleagues to help with the second series. So, and the moment I thought we should do a Ligier one, then Marcus, it was an obvious conversation, and he didn't take very long to. Well, it didn't take very long to say yes. Let's put it that way. So, we might struggle to have too much disagreement on this, but let's see how we go.
We'll start with our number 10 place, which can sometimes be a little bit contentious because, you know, it's who you leave out and is in 11th place. But in 10th place, very experienced driver. Now, remember, we're not talking about the drivers and, you know, how this driver might have raced at you know, Renault or elsewhere, but for Ligier. René Arnoux spent 86 to 89 with Ligier and started 53 times, and he just scrapes into your list. Why is that?
Kevin said I was quite enthusiastic about doing this list, and once I'd got to 5 or 6, I suddenly thought, blimey, who else is going to fill the top 10? Because there really is a massive drop-off. such was the story of Ligier. René Arnoux, if he'd left Ligier after one season in 1986, he'd be higher up this list. Had he not joined them until 1987, he wouldn't be in the list at all. it's predominantly because of the 86 season. So he'd come back. That was the year he came back to Formula One after being sacked by Ferrari just one race into the 85 season. He was alongside Jacques Lafitte, who was the favourite son of Ligier, had already been back there for 1 year. They had the Renault V6 turbo engine. The car was quite decent over the first half of that season. There were some competitive showings, and Arnoux was actually comprehensively quicker than Lafitte, although Lafitte raced very well. There was a memorable race where they ran 1-2 in the Detroit Grand Prix with Lafitte in front of Arnoux. But then came Lafitte's British Grand Prix accident, where he broke his legs and he was replaced by Philippe Alliot for the rest of the season. And Arnoux against Lafitte he was competitive, and we have to regard Lafitte as a very, very good F1 driver. So that's the reason he makes the top 10. After that, it all went off the rails a bit. Ligier did a deal with Alfa Romeo for engines for 87, and then Arnoux decided to slag them off to the Italian press, and Alfa Romeo said, right, we're not supplying you engines anymore. And his career over the last 3 years was more noticeable for being criticised by James Hunt on the commentaries.
Yes.
he just about sneaks in. And I did make the comment in this top 10 that perhaps Olivier Grillard was unlucky not to make the top 10, who was Arnoux's teammate in his last season at Ligier. Grillard started very brightly, but then in 89 and was really blowing off Arnoux as a Formula 3000 graduate, but then he started crashing quite a bit, and that sort of hampered his case to be in this top 10 really, and then went off to Osella for the following season. So Arnoux, yeah, just about makes it in. Great character. Probably not a great character if you were another Formula One driver in the 1980s, but one of the quickest blokes of the 80s on his day, in the right car, which probably wasn't the case at Ligier.
So Kevy scrapes in.
Yeah, I think that. I was chuckling to myself there. I agree with it. Well, I must admit, if I think Arnoux in Elysier, I immediately think of whichever James Hunt put down was going on. The one that stands in my mind is the Monaco one, where Murray Walker very, very coolly just says, oh, and Arnoux's talking about he's struggling to adapt from turbos to normally aspirated engines. And James Hunt's response is suitably short and concise. And I suspect probably quite accurate as well, given that the top drivers did go from the turbos normally aspirated with no trouble at all. So I struggle a little bit just because I think of him just getting in the way of the front runners was the only time we ever seemed to see him in the Ligier. But yeah, 1986 probably just does scrape him in. I've got another name I wanted to put to Marcus and see how close he came to getting in as well, because I one of the names that came to my mind when thinking Ligier was Eric Comas. How close did he to? Because obviously he perhaps didn't compare as well against his teammate as I'd thought when I actually went away and looked it up. But how close did Comas get to coming into the list?
Yeah, he was on that borderline. If they'd been a top 13, he would certainly have been in it. But yeah, I mean, he was up alongside Thierry Boutsen for his two seasons, and the first season, 92, he was a bit disappointing against Boutsen. Sorry, 91, wasn't it? 91 was the first season, and he was a bit disappointing against Boutsen, who had had a very good career at Williams, but wasn't especially renowned as the quickest driver in Formula One. They began to get more level pegging over the second half of 92, I would put him a shade behind Boutsen in the same way as Griard is behind Arnoux. And does Boutsen make the top 10? Well, that's something we may find out.
Let's move on into number 9th position. And of course, this list isn't about whether a driver is fast or slow for a team, but also whether they can keep it on the road as well. That does factor in. In 9th place, Andrea De Cesaris. Ligier years 84 to 85. Started 27 times for the team. Why did you put him in 9th place?
It's a similar-ish reasoning to the Arnoux factor, actually, in the sense that De Cesaris had a year alongside Jacques Lafitte in 1985, and that was De Cesaris' second year at Ligier, and it was Lafitte's returning year after 2 years at Williams, which hadn't gone particularly well. And on pace, really, De Cesaris did have Lafitte covered, really, over that season on racecraft, etc. On Sundays, it wasn't.
Racecraft, that's a brilliant phrase for De Cesaris.
It wasn't quite the case. But the thing with De Cesaris, I mean, he was maddening in the amount of accidents that he had. He was maddening in his belligerent track manners, but he could do something like finish fourth in the Monaco Grand Prix a minute ahead of Lafitte in the same car, with the same opportunities. So on a circuit where if you make a mistake, you're probably going to be out of the race immediately. So that's the reasoning, really, for him just about making it into the top 10. And I mean, his first year at Ligier in 84, it was the first year where they had turbo engines with the Renault V6. And he was up alongside Francois Henault, who come straight from French Formula 3. So he was basically paying for the drive. So that was a very, very difficult season for the team with unreliability, and nobody was really going to get an opportunity to do well. But in 85, he showed the flashes that just about get him into the top 10. He also showed rather unfortunate car-destroying skills, which got him kicked out of Ligier a few races before the end of the season and replaced by Philippe Streff.
So, but that's why he's down in 9th place then, Kev. Then for you, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't see where else you can put him, really. You have to have him ahead of Arnoux, because I think there's a high percentage of actually doing a decent job while at Ligier for De Cesaris than Arnoux. But you definitely can't push him ahead of the next drivers on the list. So yeah, I think he's a nailed on 9th, which is probably the first time I've said that in this series.
All right, well, let's move on to a name that's certainly familiar to many people who followed Formula One back at this time, and that's Thierry Boutsen. Let's find out why he's eighth on the list after spending Ligier years 91 to 92 and 32 starts for the team, and he makes eighth. Why is that?
Ah, so he did make it. It's more of a gut feeling based on what he'd come from before. So he'd had a couple of years at Williams in 1989 and 1990 and scored a couple of excellent wins for them. I mean, you know, holding off Ayrton Senna throughout the Hungarian Grand Prix, winning in the wet at Adelaide. He was obviously a very, very good Grand Prix driver and then took a rather large step down the pecking order in 91 to join Ligier when Williams signed up the returning Nigel Mansell. Pretty much terrible season with their Lamborghini engines and rookie Eric Comas alongside him in the other car. 92, he just often seemed to be knocking on the door of points, which obviously in those days only went down to sixth place. And they had the Renault engines, so things were beginning to look a lot better for them. And Comas actually shaped up as well, but unfortunately the relationship between them wasn't very good because they had a couple of incidents with each other for which each blamed the other and they could never really find an agreement. But so there were, you know, typical sort of solid boots and performances, not particularly outstanding, but just safe pair of hands really. And it would have been interesting to see him at Ligier maybe a year later. Well, actually we're probably his career's declining actually a year later, but I was going to say when they began to look quite competitive with the British drivers who we may come on to. You know, it would have been interesting to see him get an opportunity there in the mid-80s because that would have been quite interesting to see how he measured up against a Lafitte or something like that. But yeah, he's number eight because he was a solid, safe pair of hands. And I think it's quite appropriate that by Formula One point structure, while Ligier were in Formula One, he's just outside the top six. And so there you go.
it's a difficult, we always, you know, we've said it on this mini series a fair amount. We need to judge the drivers on the time they spent with this team, not the team that he just come out of the Canon sponsored Williams and as a race winner, but ending up with Ligier and as we've heard, you know, ending up in a very different part of the grid. But Kev, what are your would you agree it's about the right place for him on the list?
I was tempted to argue pushing him a spot higher on the basis that I think the difference between these two drivers is really the time that they're at the team. In that the person in seventh place just had better kit, and if we're extrapolating to what they did at other teams, I would say the person at number seven on this list left quite a lot on the table when they were up against a proper driver, if you like, as a teammate. But you could sort of say the same about Boutsen, and then you kind of look at their results and the guy next on the list got three podiums with Ligier, whereas Boutsen, who was there for longer, made more starts, which we sometimes factor in, but he only scored a couple of points. So I think you'd be making quite a big point, I think, to push Boutsen up to seventh. So in the end, I end.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
I ended up agreeing with Marcus again, I'm afraid.
No problem to agree. Well, let's get on to number seven, who you've just mentioned, and that is someone who was with Ligier in 1982, would start 14 times for the team. So we rewind a little bit now to the early 1980s when Eddie Cheever was driving a Ligier. Why put him seventh?
It's a season that people tend to forget that he had because he really became renowned as your archetypal solid Formula One journeyman throughout the 1980s. At the time he went to Ligier, he was actually quite a highly rated up-and-coming talent who'd had his first full season of Formula One with Osella, which he obviously wasn't going to achieve very much, but then had gone to Tyrrell in 81 and had actually looked quite good on occasion, and was paired for most of that season with Michele Alboreto. So he was a driver on the up in 82. Unfortunately, Ligier was a team slightly on the down. Lafitte had come pretty close to winning the world championship in 81, and stayed on for 82, and they carried on using the same car, which was a bit heavy. It was beginning to get a little bit uncompetitive, but some of Cheever's performances were absolutely superb, especially when they finally brought out the new JS19 for the Monaco Grand Prix. It was a complete disaster, and they said, and then the North American races were coming up, so they said, right, well, we'll just take the JS17 to the North American races, and Cheever was, you know, absolutely superb. Then the JS19 reappeared for the balance of the season, and Cheever had another fantastic performance in Las Vegas, and Monza he was good as well. He actually scored, I think Kevin said it was 3 podiums, when he was just talking about the, you know, referring to him at the end of the boots segment we just did. Lafitte only scored 1 that year, and he'd nearly won the world championship the year before. And Guy Ligier rated Cheever as a test driver, and it was a really promising season, and so promising that he went to Renault for 83, got blown away by Alain Prost, and from that point on, he was Eddie Cheever archetypal Formula One journeyman. but really, his performance in 82, as much as he could within the constraints of the equipment, which was significantly less competitive than Ligier had in the previous few seasons, were really, really good.
Kev?
Yeah, I think you've got to agree with all that. It's easy to think of... It is worth remembering that Cheever was an up-and-comer at that point. He hadn't yet had the absolute brick wall in his career that was Alain Prost. I mean, it wasn't close, was it, in 83 at Renault? But he stands up very well against someone else on this list that should be higher up this. I don't think we're giving much away to say that his teammate's going to be further up this list. So that counts for him. Yeah, the results were pretty strong, certainly with those peaks that Marcus discussed. So yeah, I think he's, yeah, having tried to argue Thierry Boutsen possibly ahead, I think actually it's the right way around.
And Kev, you did your top 10 American drivers list as well earlier this year, and he did okay on that list as well.
I just think that's kind of the way to sum him up, really. Is generally, he was just okay. Yeah. It's like he didn't really deliver what his early promise. 82 is perhaps his last kind of, oh, this guy's good season. And then after that, you know, it wasn't only against Prost. Obviously, he was then, we talked about in the Arrows list, we talked about his time alongside Derek Warwick, which started off close, and Derek more and more got the upper hand on him, really. And he just never quite delivered on that. On that potential in Formula One. But I mean, he had a long career there. He definitely falls into the kind of solid journeyman, score a few points occasionally type driver. So I don't think he's one of those great lost talents that should have been a multi world champion or anything like that. Would he? For Series 3, one of my lists will be the top 10 Grand Prix drivers not to win a Formula One race, world championship race. And he's not sure he's even going to quite make that. He'll probably be in my long list and then not make the 10. But perhaps I shouldn't say that in case I change my mind when I actually write it.
All right, look, we've mentioned there might be a Brit or two possibly on this list. Let's fast forward into the early 90s era where Mark Blundell drove for Ligier in 1993. Did a 16 start season. Why did he just miss out on being a top 5 driver for Ligier then?
It was very, very close. And in 1993, which was his first season it was his only season at Ligier.
Yeah.
But in 1993, he was alongside Martin Brundle. Obviously, had a fair bit of experience in Formula One, almost a decade's worth. And Blundell only had one season alongside Brundle, funnily enough, at Brabham in 1991. And then in 1992, he'd been McLaren test driver and also won the Le Mans 24 Hours with Peugeot, which you would imagine may have been reasonably significant in getting a Ligier drive the following year. In 93, the two of them were so evenly matched. Based on that season, you might even be talking about an equal number fives. But I'm probably going to give away who's at number five now, aren't I? But but Brundle went back to Ligier in 1995 and put in some more really good performances by this time alongside Olivier Panis. And for me, 95 sort of swung it Brundle's way, which is obviously a bit unfortunate for Mark Blundell because he didn't have an opportunity to do that. But yeah, he was very impressive. I think it was the first five Grand Prix he out-qualified Brundle. But then it evened out. And I think from memory, they were absolute level pegging by the end of the season. Brundle, you would say out of the... It's what you'd expect, really, bearing in mind their relative levels of experience. But Brundle was probably the more consistent racer. Blundell perhaps had the higher peaks, but more incidents. A very strong season. They both scored plenty of points. They had the same Renault engine deal as they'd had in 92 with Thierry Boutsen, which we've already covered. Mm-hmm. But they also added a deal with Williams, who, of course, were the benchmark Renault team, the world championship winning Renault team. They had a deal with Williams to use their gearboxes. And also the team was under new ownership. Cyril de Rouve, the ex-AGS owner, had bought into the team. And he was a bit more open to using non-French drivers and British drivers, although unfortunately for the team, he was in prison for fraud during that year. And the team was then bought by another colourful character, Flavio Briatore. So behind the scenes, things were perhaps not running particularly smoothly. But yeah, Blundell, very good season with Ligier. It's a shame he didn't have another one, and it's a shame that his Formula One career wasn't as long as it should have been. But he was. I think he thoroughly deserves to be number six and could perhaps be a little bit unlucky not to be number five, or at least equal five.
Well, I'll tell you what then. Let's introduce number five before we can debate the order they're in. And we've mentioned already, Martin Brundle is fifth in the list. Two spells at Ligier, 93 and 1995. 27 starts and he is fifth. So teammates there absolutely next to each other on our list, Kev, fifth and sixth. Are they just about in the right order for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think you'd be having to make a big point to put Blundell ahead. You'd have to be leaning on the less experienced than Martin when he was there, I think, to say, oh, when that... as a result of that, he therefore did better. But I mean, if you just to underline Marcus's point about how close they were in 93, on the super times, which is where we average the pace, so it's the fastest lap of each driver across the season, there's 0.06% between them. I mean, that's absolutely nothing. They were very close on performance. But if you look at some of the criteria that matters, especially to a team battling in the midfield, you know, Brundle did score more points. Yeah, that's important. He brought the points home. And the big thing for me is the 95 performances, you know, where he's when he does drive in 95 for Ligier, he's better than the incumbent driver who we may get onto speaking about shortly. And then there were star performances like the Belgian Grand Prix where he was third, even though I think he was a little bit naughty with some of his on-track moves against Damon Hill towards the end of the race. I remember that. Damon was on the receiving end that day because he'd already been Michael Schumacher earlier on in the race. So it wasn't one of his happier days, but it was still a brilliant performance to finish third in one of those tricky conditions. And that's where an experienced, good quality driver can really make a difference for a midfield team. If you get one of those changeable conditions, crazy races, you want someone who's going to be on the ball enough, keep it out the wall, keep it out of trouble, and suddenly you get, you know, a third or a fifth instead of your usual 8th, 10th, 12th position. So I think Martin got very good at that, and he had to really, because he very rarely had any, you know, had decent enough equipment to run anywhere near the front. So yeah, I think the 95 thing definitely pushes him ahead of Blundell for me.
the podium as well in 93 at the San Marino Grand Prix. Hill ahead of him with brake failure, but still getting those results, which probably swings it just in his favour. But obviously, you know, Marcus, you've not had your say on Martin Brundle yet and why you put him ahead of Blundell.
I sort of almost explained it when I was talking about Mark Brundle. But, and actually, ironically, obviously, well, maybe not ironically, but amusingly, the two of them still great friends, and they went into business together running their management company, racing driver management company, 2MB. He was a very, very good pro in Formula One by that time, wasn't he? And apart from 93, which we've mentioned, the 95 performances alongside Olivier Panis were really excellent, quite a lot of them. And that was with the Mugen Honda engines by then, perhaps weren't necessarily as strong as a proposition as the Renault had been before that. He wasn't driving the full season because Aguri Suzuki was bringing money to do a handful of races that year. So he didn't have the continuity either, which however experienced you are, you need that. But I mentioned the Mugen engines, and his name crops up in conversation very briefly a couple of minutes ago, Michael Schumacher. He clearly never raced a Ligier, but it was a test in a Ligier that actually meant that the team used the Mugen engines in 95, because he'd won the championship for Benetton in 94 with Ford power, tested the Ligier with its Renault engine, said, oh, this is really good. So Flavio Briatore, who at that time owned both teams, said, right, we're having the Renaults for the Benettons. and leaving the Ligiers to have the Mugens. So, and the car was also dubbed the Blue Benetton because of its because it looked reasonably similar, as you might expect, with the same chap owning both teams. But Brundle just about gets it over Blundell. And actually, similarly to what I was saying about Mark Blundell, I sort of felt a little bit as though he was perhaps unlucky not to be one place further up as well. But we might get to that in a moment.
Well, let's move on to fourth place, and we get on to a Ligier winner. Ligier years 94 to 96, started 49 times, and as I've mentioned, a Ligier winner. Olivier Panis in fourth place.
As I just said in the lead-in, perhaps Martin Brundle was unlucky not to be ahead of him, because if you look at it, the only real decent barometer Panis had alongside him during the years when Ligier was called Ligier. So we're going to have to make the distinction at this point, because obviously it changed hands and became Prost in 1997, and Jarno Trulli came in, and but we're discounting the post 96 seasons. This is just Ligier. But Brundle was the only truly worthwhile teammate he had during the time at Ligier, and probably Brundle was a bit quicker than him. But funnily enough, Panis, despite being in the early stages of a Formula One career, sort of seemed to be good at harvesting the old points and getting the car to the finish in high positions in races of high attrition. But the real standout that puts him at number four is that win in Monaco. And I was actually there. Funnily enough, I was there working as a journalist, one of the few Grand Prix I have worked as a journalist, and I was watching the race by the swimming pool, there's a big screen on the hill where you can see what's happened elsewhere around the circuit, and it was just the most remarkable race. And obviously by the end of it, only three cars were still running, but Panis had been properly doing some overtaking on people, and it was just one of those miracle standout performances that just come along once in a blue moon. And we don't see enough of him in Formula One. Actually, we do a little bit more recently, but we went through many years where it was just so predictable, wasn't it? You knew that only one of two or three drivers could win a Grand Prix, but this was one of those real stat. And it wasn't just a fluked result. He really earned it as well, driving up from the middle of the grid. And as I said, doing a lot of overtaking. And yeah, he proved that he was quick when it became Prost, although, yeah, we're leaving that out for now. He was in world championship contention early in that 97 season. He just about shades it over Brundle, I think.
Yeah, and what a swan song as well for the Ligier name, which is we're focusing on that name in Formula One. Kev, hard to argue him above fourth place, but hard to argue below, perhaps.
Yeah, I think he has to be fourth. I mean, even looking at 95, as Marcus alluded to, he did score more points than Martin. Or I think Brundle was obviously, first of all, didn't do the full campaign. You could argue he was a little bit more unlucky. But yeah, on that score, Panis is ahead. But the 1996 Monaco Grand Prix. I mean, let's remember that he started 14th. He did do some overtaking, including my favourite, which was putting Eddie Irvine rather wide at Lowe's hairpin. That was a good one. And although sadly for some other people in the race, that didn't put Irvine out of the race. He was able to cause chaos later on. But then he also held off David Coulthard at the end in the McLaren. He did the second fastest lap of the race. So it was a genuine, it was a day of days type event. And I think it's 15 years since Ligier had won a race as well. So remarkable. And yeah, I just, when you think of Panis, I know he drove for other teams, but when I think of Panis, I think of him in blue and leading the Ligier line. So, but yeah, I don't think he can get, we're talking about different eras when we're going to compare him to the top three. But I think the other three were, for different reasons, they just have to be ahead of him on the list. So I think sort of last of the winners.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
And first of the modern, more modern era, I think is entirely fair.
Okay, well, look, let's get into that top three then, and that might be where the order gets argued and juggled around, or maybe it's a top three that can only be in this order. Number three, let's go back to the 1970s era. Now, he would start seven times and he would be a Ligier winner. Patrick Depailler, third place then, why here?
The gulf between number three and number four is by far the biggest of any in this top ten. So absolutely not one second of doubt in contemplating this, who my top three were. The reason why Patrick Depailler has to slot in at number three is just because he only did the seven races. Yeah, we haven't got enough of a Ligier career to go on. Had he at least made it to 15 races and completed the 79 season, he could well have been world champion and he might be top of this list. But unfortunately, he decided it would be a great idea in the middle of a racing season to go hang gliding. The hang glider crashed with, I was going to say, disastrous results as a consequence, but actually I think he was blooming lucky to get away with broken legs, from which he was still recovering when he started the 1980 season with Alfa Romeo, having been sacked by Guy Ligier as a result of going hang gliding. Whether he would have sacked him if he'd gone hang gliding and then landed absolutely safely is another matter.
Surely not.
Actually, Guy Ligier probably wouldn't have even known. but anyway, he came in at the start of the 79 season as Ligier expanded to a two-car team for the first time. Well, I say the first time, but they had run two cars in the 77 Japanese Grand Prix as a one-off. But in 79... full-time two-car team, coming in alongside Jacques Lafitte. He'd been at Tyrrell for absolutely yonks. And Ligier had switched to the Cosworth engines that season, and the car was absolutely dominant at the start of that year. Jacques Lafitte won the first two races. Lafitte was a bit annoyed at the signing of Depailler. He wanted the team to impose a number one, number two hierarchy, and which I think it's a bit rich because arguably you might have given it to Depailler at that time. but anyway, they didn't. And it didn't really matter anyway because Lafitte was so well entrenched within Ligier that he was clearly the guy who was up and running at the start of the 79 season and won the first two Grand Prix. But by the time the F1 season came to Europe, Depailler was really getting into his swing and won the Spanish Grand Prix. Then really the Belgian Grand Prix is the one where they really suffered as a consequence of not having the team orders because the two Ligier drivers just frantically battled it out with the result they both completely killed their tyres and one of them crashed. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Lafitte, but anyway, and then there came Monaco, and Jody Scheckter by this time had won two races on the trot for Ferrari and they were beginning to become the form team, and then Depailler had his hang gliding accident. But on the form that he'd had in the last two or three races at that time, you could say that had he stayed there, and he was also a very he was renowned to be a very good test driver. So had he remained with the team and they hadn't gone down development blind alleys in the second half of 79, which were actually mostly at the behest of Guy Ligier himself rather than any of his technical people, Depailler could possibly have ended up being a world champion, and certainly so if he stayed on for 1980. He was a very, very fast, very, very fast driver. Won a Grand Prix with Ligier in just his fifth or sixth start, and that's why he's clearly at number three in the list.
Yeah, arriving at Ligier as an established force in Grand Prix racing, a race winner, as you say, and someone who perhaps, Kev, is he on this list so high up because of the, you know, what could have been with his time with the team?
Well, it's funny, when I was kind of, I tried to think of what my list would look like before then, obviously opening up what Marcus had written, and my gut feeling was to have Depailler at number two. And then when I looked at I was actually shocked that he'd only done the seven races, because when I think of Ligier, I think of Lafitte and Depailler running around in 79, but only the seven races. I found it, I was quite taken aback, really. It shows the impact that moment had for Ligier. Sadly, it was Depailler that crashed at the Belgian Grand Prix, crashed out of it. Lafitte finished second to Scheckter on that one. And actually, if you look at we mentioned the Super Times before, for 79, Depailler comes out number one. Now, obviously, he wasn't there to then drive the car in the second half of the year as it fell away. So that's probably a bit of a false impression, but it gives you an idea of how quick he was in those first seven races. So for me, he has to be third because he did win that race. He looked really impressive, compared very well to the incumbent, but only seven races. I mean, how far up can you push someone on seven races, particularly when you've got two, you know, I think, very good drivers there for longer. I completely agree with his although I was shocked when I first opened it, it makes total sense, which is why we have people doing the research to do these lists.
You know, and a different, you were talking about hang gliding halfway through, you know, a season. Formula One drivers these days, it's in the contract, they can't do dangerous sports. The most dangerous thing they'll do is a bit of mountain cycling for their fitness or something over the summer break. But of course, it was a different era of Grand Prix driver and a different era of safety as well, which would of course eventually cost him his life, and it is very hard putting these lists together, I guess, for you guys, because there is so much, you know, with a driver that then goes on to different teams and you can see how they develop. And although we always talk about the driver in these top 10 lists with their time at the team, there's so much unknown with what his career could have been as a very quick driver, but also a kind of throw everything at, you know, you use the phrase life is for living in your piece. And that kind of sums up him as a driver.
He was very much a free spirit. He really ticks the boxes of the romantic image of a racing driver, if you like. He was renowned as being a non-conformist, even in the 1970s, we regard as being non-conformist. So he probably would have belonged more in the 50s, really, as far as that's concerned. I would imagine that a driver like him, as the commercial influence in Formula One became stronger and stronger, probably would have felt less and less at home and happy. But then you also think, well, that was an era where the careers weren't anywhere near as long as they are now, because we did have the much inferior safety standards, which clearly took their own toll. But you also had drivers doing 7 or 8 years in Formula One and then getting out while they were still in one piece, rather than carrying on for 15 years, 20 years, like we see today. So by 1979 was Depailler's sixth season in Formula One. So would he maybe have gone on for 2 more years or something? Difficult to tell. But I do think that, you know, had he not decided hang gliding was a great idea, stayed at Ligier for 1980, it could have been a very close run thing in the championship between him and Alan Jones at Williams.
And then his window would have,
what ifs.
His window would have closed shortly afterwards, because the Prost, Senna, Piquet, returning Lauder, Mansell era was just around the corner. And I think that as a group they moved the bar beyond some of the drivers that we're talking about there.
Well, let's get on to a couple of drivers now. We're going to talk about the second place and the first place together, because once we do number two, it'll be obvious who number one is. So in second on your list, Didier Pironi. Didier Pironi, Ligier in 1980, started 14 times, was a double pole sitter and a single-time race winner. And first on your list, you put Jacques Lafitte. Two spells with the team, 132 starts, 6 wins, 7 poles, was always probably going to be number one on your list. That's why I thought I'd mention those two now, because there's not much to wait for the number one, but we'll talk about them together. Didier Pironi in second, Marcus.
Well, I think you might have ruined it for some of the listeners, Martin, because
a possible debate.
Some of them might have been expecting Pedro Diniz to be at number one. one of my absolute clear memories from my youth, at 13 years old in this case, my dad and I at the 1980 British Grand Prix, and I don't know why we watched that one from the exit of Druids, because we were normally South Bank people at Brands Hatch, but anyway, we did, and I remember the field coming through at the end of lap one, and from the exit of Druids you could see the approach to paddock so right at the beginning of the lap. Pironi shot into view. It seemed like we waited 10 seconds for the next car, to the extent where you think there must have been a massive pile up out in the country or something, but no, the second car shot into view, and that was Jacques Lafitte. And then came the Williamses, and then, you know, there weren't any holes in the field. The Ligier was so dominant around that track. And it's a fairly long-winded way of getting to it, Martin, but you mentioned one victory, but really it should have been for Pironi, but really it should have been quite a lot more, because he won that Belgian Grand Prix at Zolder. That was his first Grand Prix win. He then was leading the Monaco Grand Prix when the car jumped out of gear going into Casino Square, which put him into the barriers. He was then leading the Spanish Grand Prix, which ultimately didn't count for points because of the FISA FOCA war at the time. It slipped my mind why he didn't win it in the end, but that was another win that got away. French Grand Prix, him and Lafitte were contenders, but they got done on tyre strategy by Williams, who chose a better diameter front wheel for their car. And then Brands Hatch, where he was absolutely dominating until not one but two punctures. In a parallel universe, we're looking back on Pironi having won 5 successive races in the middle of 1980. And he was at the time thought to be the fastest thing in Formula One, which Gilles Villeneuve obviously put to bed the following year when they were teammates at Ferrari. But it was a really impressive season from a driver who was renowned as well and truly up and coming at the time after a couple of seasons with Tyrrell. And he did a very good job. He also did a very good job of signing a nice deal with Ferrari behind the backs of Ligier and his people and rather annoying them. But really, Jacques Lafitte has to be number one just because of his, I think I used the word talismanic in the piece, but that's what he was to Ligier. But funnily enough, he wasn't the intended driver when they first launched the team. That was supposed to be Jean-Pierre Beltoise when they launched the team at the end of 1975. But then there was a change of heart and Lafitte was put in and for the start of 76, and he had seven consecutive seasons there. And you know, he really carried that team in the cockpit over the first three seasons. Solo car, won the Swedish Grand Prix in 77, then had stiff competition from very, very quick teammates in 79 and 80, Depailler and Pironi. But actually, Kevin, you mentioned the super times for 79. I'd be interested to see what they are for 80. But I know that the qualifying head-to-head between Lafitte and Pironi is actually much closer than you'd think it was. Something like 8-6 to Pironi or something like that.
It's just under, yeah, I was looking it up while you were talking, actually, that the super times gap between Pironi and Lafitte in 1980 is just under 0.3%. So it's significant enough to say, for you to say, well, that Pironi was the quicker, probably, but not, it's not the sort of, it's not a thrashing by any means. Yeah, that's a perfectly respectable gap.
Yeah, I mean, Lafitte was quicker than people give him credit for, and clearly, obviously, that extended into 81 as well, when the Matra engines returned under Talbot branding for the team that year. And Lafitte came closer than he'd ever done to winning the World Championship with a couple of wins in Austria and Canada. That was another superb season. The return in 85 and 86 as well. He was showing some of his old form until that day at Brands Hatch where his Formula One career ended. So, by that point, that was, you know, over 10 seasons since he and Ligier had started a Grand Prix together for the first time. So his significance in the Ligier history is absolutely at the top. And actually, his place as a quick Ligier driver is also without doubt, and he's not anywhere near as shaded as you would imagine by drivers of the caliber of Depailler and Pironi.
Well, he probably suffers a bit because of the comparison. When he was at Williams, like that wasn't very good. You know, he was quite considerably, you know, blown away by Keke Rosberg, I think. I know he had a few good days there, but nothing like what you would say his peaks were at Ligier. But yeah, just to back up Marcus's point, really. I mean, Ligier scored 9 wins in Formula One, and Lafitte scored 6 of them. He was only 6 points off of Nelson Piquet's, you know, total in 1981. So that's obviously in the days where they didn't give 25 points for a win. I think it was still 9 at that point, wasn't it? Hadn't quite got to 10 yet.
It was 9.
Yeah. 9 for a win, 6 for a second. So he's 1 second place away. And, you know, he's miles ahead of everyone else on the stats, really, including number of starts. I think he had to be number one. I kind of like to think of it as Pironi being marginally the fastest Ligier driver, unless we include Alain Prost's one-off test that he did many years later. Probably Pironi the fastest Ligier racing driver by a small amount, but Lafitte's miles out front for this overall list, I think.
Well, there we go. Another fantastic top 10 put together. Something I hadn't realised until I saw the research for this show was that actually his career-ending accident was something that led to Formula One changing the safety rules after that to ensure that the driver's front feet were behind the front axle, which just seems kind of crazy that it wasn't that long ago in Formula One that rule came in.
It's quite amazing some of the what we would consider to be quite basic and obvious safety. I mean, is having the driver's feet behind the front axle a safety feature? I mean, I would have thought that would be a fairly obvious thing to do, really. But, you know, I suppose it's easy with hindsight. But, of course, the other thing about that race is that was the race in which he matched Graham Hill's number of world championship starts. So for a while, they were the two at the top of the table with the most. And then, of course, Riccardo Patrese came along and blew that away. And now they all do more than 300, it seems. Well, Vettel's going to end on 299, isn't he? He's not quite going to make 300. But I mean, those days, 176 was, you know, that was record-breaking levels, you know, career length. And, of course, most of it was at Ligier.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, thank you very much, guys, for joining us on the podcast today for another Top 10 list. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as well, and maybe you want to agree or disagree with the order. You're very welcome to let us know. Thank you very much for everyone that's leaving some feedback on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. A little star rating and a few words about the podcast that we do, whether it's the regular staff or the little mini-series that we work on. I hope you enjoy listening, and thank you if you have.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Have left a review most recently. That has been the Autosport Podcast, and we'll see you on the next one.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is MMA fighter Clay Guida, and I'm not afraid of anyone or anything, but losing my hair was an entirely different kind of fight. So if you're suffering from hair loss like I was, then you gotta check out my boys at Bosley. Pound for pound, they are the champions of hair restoration. That's why I turned to Bosley to get my hair back. The entire Bosley team was so professional and kind from start to finish. All it took was a simple one-day procedure, and I was on my way back to rocking my full hair again. So take it from me. Don't wait if you are thinning or receding. I'm so thrilled with my results, I just wish I would have went to Bosley sooner. It's time to finally knock out hair loss because the best is yet to come. Check out Bosley today.
When MMA fighter Clay Guida was losing his hair, he trusted Bosley to get it back. Now it's your turn. Get a free information kit, plus get a $250 off gift card when you text CLAY to 203203. Text CLAY to 203203 or go to Bosley.com. That's Bosley.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.